You're listening to Radio Hangar. Aviation talk, powered by AI, fueled by passion. Welcome back to the hangar. I'm Taildragger, and friends, today I want to take you somewhere special. I want to take you back to a time when stepping onto an airplane felt like stepping into the future. When the terminal wasn't a cattle chute, it was a cathedral. When a ticket wasn't just transportation, it was a ticket to the world. I'm talking about Pan American World Airways, Pan Am, and the golden age of international air travel. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now I need to tell you what got me thinking about this. I was down at Sun N Fun a few years back, walking the flight line early in the morning before the crowd showed up. You know that hour, the dew's still on the grass. The sun's coming up gold behind the tree line, smells like AVGAs and coffee and cut grass. Perfect morning, and I come around the corner of a row of warbirds, and there she is. A beautifully restored Martin 130 flying boat. Not a full-size one, mind you. This was a detailed replica built to about 3/4 scale by a group out of Florida. But the paint scheme, oh, the paint scheme, Pan Am blue and white. That globe logo on the tail, I stopped dead in my tracks. There was an old fellow sitting in a lawn chair next to it. Had to be in his 90s, white hair, Pan Am cap on his head, and a coffee in his hand. I walked up and said, "That's about the prettiest thing on this field today." He looked up at me and smiled and said, "Son, you should have seen the real ones. Pull up a chair. Let me tell you about them." Pan American Airways started in 1927. And I mean started small. We're talking a single Fokker F7 trimotor flying mail between Key West, Florida, and Havana, Cuba. The founder was a man named Juan Terry Tripp. Now there's a name that sounds like it belongs in aviation history. Tripp was a Yale man, a Navy pilot, and he had a vision that most people thought was certifiably insane. He wanted to connect the entire world by air. Think about that for a second. 1927. Lindbergh just crossed the Atlantic solo that same year. Most people still thought of airplanes as dangerous contraptions for daredevils and mail carriers, and here's Tripp saying, "No, we're going to fly passengers across oceans, regular service." On a schedule, the man was either a genius or out of his mind. Turned out he was both. Now here's where it gets interesting. The problem with flying across oceans in the late 20s and 30s was pretty obvious. There was no place to land. The Pacific Ocean is about 8,500 miles across from San Francisco to Manila. No airplane on Earth could fly that far without stopping, and there weren't exactly airports dotting the mid-Pacific. So Tripp did something extraordinary. He built them. Pan Am literally constructed bases on tiny islands scattered across the Pacific. Wake Island, Midway, Guam. They shipped in construction crews, fuel, supplies, everything by boat. They carved out harbors for flying boats and built hotels for passengers on islands that had nothing but coral and seabirds. The airplane they used for this was the Martin M130, the China Clipper. And that's what that old fellow at Sun N Fun had been working on his whole life, a tribute to that airplane. The China Clipper was a four-engine flying boat, wingspan of 130 feet. She could carry up to 32 passengers in what I can only describe as a flying yacht. We're talking private sleeping berths, a dining room where you sat down at a table with white linen and silver and ate a five-course meal at 10,000 feet over the Pacific. The first scheduled trans-Pacific airmail flight left San Francisco on November 22, 1935. The China Clipper, registration number NC14716, Captain Edwin Music at the controls, they flew from Alameda, California to Manila in the Philippines. 6 days, 5 stops, nearly 8,500 miles. Now let me paint this picture for you because it deserves it. San Francisco Bay, late afternoon. 25,000 people packed the shoreline to watch. The Golden Gate Bridge wasn't even finished yet. It was still under construction, and the China Clipper had to fly under the incomplete span on departure because the ceiling was low, and Music needed every bit of altitude he could save. He dipped that big flying boat under the bridge cables and climbed out over the Pacific. The crowd went absolutely wild. Can you imagine? Can you imagine watching that silver airplane disappear into the west, knowing it was headed for the other side of the world? Captain Music? I want to talk about him for a minute because he deserves it. Edwin Music was Pan Am's chief pilot, a quiet, serious man, built like a fireplace. He'd flown airmail in the early days, the dangerous years when the mortality rate for airmail pilots was something horrifying, like one fatality for every 400,000 miles flown. Music survived by being meticulous. He checked everything twice, 3 times. He insisted on procedures when most pilots were still flying by, feel and bravado. Music made that first Pacific crossing look routine. It wasn't. The navigation was celestial. By the stars, same way sailors had done it for centuries, except now you're moving at 130 knots instead of 8. The radio equipment was primitive. The weather forecasting across the Pacific was essentially guesswork. If you hit a storm, you flew through it or around it and hoped your fuel calculations held up. Tragically, Ed Music was killed in January of 1938. His Sikorsky S-42, the Samoan Clipper, went down near Pago Pago during a survey flight. They were dumping fuel after an engine problem, and the fuel ignited. 7 souls lost. He was 43 years old. Pan Am named their new Boeing 314 Clipper after him. Because that's what you do. You honor the ones who paved the way. And oh, the Boeing 314. Now we're talking about the golden age in full bloom. The 314 was the airplane that made transatlantic passenger service a reality. First flight, June 28, 1939. These were enormous flying boats, wingspan of 152 feet. They carried 74 passengers during the day, or 36 in sleeping berths at night. They had a dining room, a lounge, dressing rooms, and a bridal suite, on an airplane. The fare for a one-way crossing from New York to Southampton, England, in 1939 was $375, adjusted for inflation. That's somewhere around $8,000 today. So this was not Greyhound. This was the province of diplomats and movie stars and captains of industry. You dressed for the flight, men in suits and ties, women in their finest. You boarded by launch boat, motoring out to the Clipper, floating in the harbor. The stewards greeted you by name. I talked to that old fellow at Sun and Fun for 3 hours that morning. Turned out he'd been a Pan Am flight engineer, hired in 1951. He missed the flying boat era by about a decade, but he'd known men who were there. He told me a story that his captain had told him about a crossing on a 314 in 1940. The captain said they were somewhere over the mid-Atlantic, middle of the night. Passengers were asleep in their berths. The navigator was taking star shots through the celestial dome, which was a little glass bubble on top of the fuselage. The flight engineer was watching his gauges, and the captain said it was the loneliest feeling in the world and the most magnificent. Nothing below you but black water for 1,000 miles in every direction. Nothing above you but stars. And this machine, this incredible machine, carrying 40 people through the darkness to another continent. He said it felt like the future. After the war, everything changed. Pan Am transitioned from flying boats to land planes, the Lockheed Constellation, the Douglas DC-6 and DC-7, and then the jet age, the Boeing 707. Pan Am put the 707 into transatlantic service on October 26, 1958, New York to Paris, and suddenly the world got small. Juan Trippe had done it. He'd connected the planet by air. The jet age was Pan Am's peak, the 1960s. Those iconic blue and white liveries, the stewardesses, they called them stewardesses then, in their powder blue uniforms designed by Don Loper. The Pan Am Worldport at John F. Kennedy Airport, that flying saucer of a terminal. If you flew internationally in the 60s, Pan Am was the airline. They were America's flag carrier in everything but name. And then came the 747, the jumbo jet. And this is where Juan Trippe's genius showed one more time. He's the one who pushed Boeing to build it. He went to Bill Allen at Boeing and essentially said, "Build me an airplane twice the size of anything flying, and I'll order 25 of them." It was the biggest commercial aviation bet in history. It nearly bankrupted Boeing. It nearly bankrupted Pan Am too. Pan Am was the launch customer, January 22, 1970. First commercial 747 flight, New York to London. 324 passengers walked onto that airplane, and the world of air travel changed forever, because now suddenly you could fill that many seats. You had to lower the fares to fill that many seats, and air travel started becoming something ordinary people could afford, which is the great irony of Pan Am's story. The airline that invented luxury air travel built the airplane that killed it. The 747 democratized flying, and that was good. That was wonderful. But Pan Am never figured out how to make money in the world it created. The decline was slow and then sudden. Deregulation in 1978, the Lockerbie bombing in 1988, fuel costs, competition, bad management decisions. Pan Am filed for bankruptcy and ceased operations on December 4, 1991. I remember that day I was a captain at another carrier by then. And I remember standing in the crew lounge watching the news, and I felt something I didn't expect. I felt grief, not for the corporation, for the idea. Pan Am represented something about aviation that was bigger than balance sheets. They represented the belief that flight could elevate us, not just physically, but spiritually. That connecting the world by air was a noble calling, not just a business. That old fellow at Sun and Fun, the flight engineer, he said something I've never forgotten. He said, "We weren't just airline employees, we were ambassadors. Every time that Clipper touched down in a foreign country, we were representing something. We were representing possibility. I think about him sometimes. I think about Captain Music disappearing into the Pacific sunset. I think about Juan Trippe, that crazy visionary, building fuel stops on coral atolls. I think about that 747 lifting off from Kennedy for the first time, heavy and magnificent. Pan Am is gone, but what they built, the roots, the standards, the belief that the sky belongs to everyone that's still flying. Today's segment drew on some wonderful sources. The Pan Am Historical Foundation archives have been invaluable, also leaned heavily on research from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and a great book called Sky Gods by Robert Gant, who was himself a Pan Am pilot. The Federal Aviation Administration Historical Archives filled in some of the regulatory details, and the story about the old flight engineer at Sun N Fun. Well, that's hangar talk, the best kind of history there is. One pilot talking to another while the sun comes up. This is Radio Hangar, an AI-generated broadcast created by folks who love aviation as much as you do. You can find all our segments and show notes at radiohangar.com. This is Tail Dragger. Go visit a museum this week. Go find a Pan Am model at a flea market. Go look up at a 747 if you're lucky enough to see one still flying, and remember that somebody dreamed that airplane into existence. Fly safe, friends. Radio Hangar. Clear skies and tailwinds.